This is Business Impact, a podcast series from UCD College of Business, Ireland's leading business school. I'm your host, Emmett Oliver, and each episode I'll be joined by world-renowned faculty from across the College of Business, as well as international industry leaders who'll offer us insight, spark curiosity, and challenge you to rethink how you do business in a changing world. Now, you're welcome back to a freshly minted edition of Business Impact for the, I was going to say late summer, but we're very much into the autumn now. There's leaves everywhere. It's a lot colder and the wind is brushing our hair very more aggressively than it was a few weeks ago. We're back into the new term here at UCD Business School, and that means more podcasts. Sorry, we've been offline for a few months, but we do have other things and day jobs and so on to get on with. But we've stacked up a good few editions in the next few months heading into the Christmas period. So I hope you'll enjoy the ride along as we head into the fourth quarter of the year. And we start off today with a very interesting conversation. We've covered on a number of occasions the issue of the climate emergency here on the podcast. A lot of different perspectives. We've looked at the accounting rules around it. We've looked at also how consumers in particular react to instruction and direction about products in the consumer domain. And we've also looked at various European level developments. But we haven't really looked at is how companies, corporates and other financial interests represent themselves in what they do every day. And this famous phrase, which is on everyone's lips these days, but it means a lot of different things to different people, and that word is greenwashing. And what does it mean? And everyone has been accusing each other of greenwashing. So we're going to put a bit of a lens on that today in our conversation. And I'm delighted to have a guest who is our second German on this podcast. She's the Assistant Professor of Accountancy in UCD, and that is Dr. Fabiola Schneider. Let me just give you a bit of a background. She's an Ad Astra Fellow, and her research is dedicated to advancing UCD's theme on sustainable global society. She was previously Assistant Professor of Finance at DCU, and her current research interests are on the climate emergency, sustainable transition, and she publishes in journals on fossil fuel financing and also on ESG reporting and impact investing. And she has a PhD thesis from UCD Michael Smurfit School, again, around the theme of climate transition, accounting and finance. Fabiola, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you along. As I said, we've covered the climate emergency a lot of times on the podcast. We've come from different vantage points, and always this word greenwashing comes up at the center of our conversation. It gets thrown out there as much as companies saying they've got very live and believable and credible green credentials, and then they get rebutted back, and there's an investigation sometimes by some of the government agencies across Europe into what they're saying. We're not going to concentrate, I think, too much in today's conversation on the consumer part, but more on the corporate side. But before we do any of that, you have a very strong sort of, you know, thematic coming through in your research, which is this idea of sustainability, the climate emergency. What's your personal motivation around it? What gets you up in the morning to cover these very interesting areas?
Well, exactly that. I learned that the most important thing in terms of sustainability is pick a career. And that's why I got into academia and sustainability research, because I think that's the biggest lever that I personally can have to foster sustainability around the planet and make the world a better place.
And obviously, coming from a German background, you come from a town, I think, just outside Frankfurt, as far as I know. We're obviously looking at Germany a little bit jealous in the sense that they've had such a longer history than Ireland in the area of environmental politics. The original Green Party in Germany was a long time established before others in other parts of Europe. So did anything in the sort of the German water influence you at all? Or is this just something that's a bit beyond your national origin?
Well, you mentioned the green politics, and that's certainly something that I was exposed to through my mother at an early age. But where I'm from, it's a car manufacturing town. So not exactly a green utopia. Car manufacturing is one of the industries at the moment undergoing quite a lot of transition, where we try to go towards more electric vehicles, but certainly when I was growing up, the town didn't look like a green ideal, but more so like a car manufacturing town. So maybe that also influenced my take on wanting to create a greener world.
Now, Fabiola, you're talking about this theme of greenwashing. It's obviously in some senses a pejorative word for some people. In some cases, it may actually have a legal meaning or a regulatory meaning. But could you just kick off the conversation today by walking us through greenwashing? Because there are a lot of different variants of it and other sort of play on that set of words. And then we can evolve into what companies and corporate interests are doing in this area. But maybe just to explore the actual word itself, because as it gets thrown around a lot, it's something that a lot of people are accused of, a lot of companies individuals, campaigns and so on. But can you just walk us through, when we use this thing greenwashing, what we may be referring to?
So very simply said, greenwashing refers to companies making themselves appear more environmentally friendly than they really are. And today it has become a many-headed beast. There's a wonderful report by Planet Tracker. It's called the Hydra Report. So think of that ancient beast where when you chop off one head, another one springs out, because really strategies in greenwashing have evolved quite sophisticatedly. So it's not just a simple thing that you might be thinking of straight away, which usually is now called green labeling. So you put a label on something, but a closer examination then reveals that actually the words are misleading. So if you go to the supermarket these days as a consumer, you see a million labels around things being environmentally friendly. The most known ones are usually hopefully the regulated ones, so an organic label or fair trade label. But then there's so many more around sustainable fisheries and so on. And the problem is when you look at them that a lot of them don't really mean what you might initially think it does. The one label that's commonly used is ocean plastic, but what ocean plastic really means is ocean bound plastic. So it is recycled plastic, which is collected within, say, 30 miles of an ocean or some waterway leading to the ocean. That is not exactly the same thing, right? If you hear ocean plastic, you probably think of someone actually going to the sea and fishing out plastic, but that's not necessarily what that label would mean. The problem is that there's so many of these labels that it's impossible for a consumer to actually follow up. I think in the EU, there's over 200 labels that refer to environmental sustainability. Globally, it's over 400. So no one can keep up with those. And you would really need to dig in who gave that label, who's verifying it, because a lot of them come from industry associations. And then it's literally like a company giving itself a label, which I don't know, in terms of accountability might not be the most effective way. But that's just the most straightforward one. There's many more. One interesting one is green lighting, which might be familiar with some people. Anyone having traveled recently to, say, an airport or a train station, I would recommend to watch out for advertisement of energy companies. So the major energy companies still heavily rely on fossil fuels. So their revenues would mainly come from oil and gas and coal. Yet if you look at the advertisements at, say, an airport, you will see that it's all solar panels, it's all wind parks and sheep, which represents really a small part of their business. And that's what green lighting is. So you highlight, you spotlight a particularly green feature, however small it is, in order to draw away the attention from the environmental damaging activities that you're conducting elsewhere.
Yeah, I suppose that one may be more appropriate. We probably see that more often than actual strictly greenwashing. A lot of companies like to highlight it might be 2% of their revenues or, you know, 1% of their profits, but let's have a big corporate report about that and a glossy, expensive TV campaign. So we absolutely do see that. Obviously, there's green labeling, there's green lighting, there's greenwashing. Is one of the problems we need to go into, first of all, in this conversation is there's no one authority source for a lot of this, you know, and that may be just the nature of the beast. But in the consumer piece, at least, and in general, I suppose, across society, that there's no one agency that says, this is what this means, this is what this means, and this is what this corresponds to. Is that kind of where what our core problem is here?
So obviously, regulators are very much aware of this issue. Greenwashing is quite pervasive, both in the consumer space, but also in the corporate reporting space. In the consumer claims, there is already an authority. So we do have the Green Claims Directive as well, which will be enforced by national consumer protection agencies, where anyone that sees a false claim can actually get active and report that claim. The problem is that this only applies to the consumer space. So advertisements which are misleading can be brought into these agencies and will get sanctioned. We saw that with a lot of the financial companies as well. So banks were advertising all their green credentials while still being major fossil fuel supporters, and therefore they were actually sanctioned, so they get to pay penalties enforced by these consumer protection agencies. The problem, however, comes when we now move to the space that I work on, corporate reporting. So corporate reporting is very different to advertisements because you don't see it, you know, on TV, you don't see it on a billboard, but instead it is financial or non-financial reporting, a sustainability report that usually is published annually by larger corporations. Now, these are also a form of advertising, if you ask me, because these are produced for external stakeholders, such as investors, but also wider society, to be informed about the company. And here as well, we will find quite a lot of green claims where companies do claim that they are sustainable leaders or that they do so much for making the world a better place. Yet here we don't really have consumer protection agencies because it is corporate reporting rather than advertising in the original sense.
And Fabiola, obviously, you know, as you say, annual reports or sustainability reports, they're picked up by investors. They're put before an AGM of a company if you're a shareholder attending. You can usually get them on the company's website if you go to investor relations. Do they need to be submitted wider than that? Obviously, the stock exchange bodies get them as well. But is there any other regulator that's looking at the content of an annual report? Or is it just kind of, as you said, buyer beware if you're a shareholder? It's really up to the shareholders to police what's said there. Or is there an actual agency that looks at strictly corporate reporting and whether there's the truth or otherwise in those reports?
So the problem is that so far it was voluntary reporting, which means even though we have a market supervisory authority, the ESMA, at European level, if it's voluntary reporting, can't really mandate anything. That's the nature of voluntary reporting. So if there's no law that requires you to report certain things, you can't really be held accountable for not doing that. Luckily, the Wild West of reporting is changing a bit. So just like financial reporting, which is already quite heavily regulated, we now, at least in Europe, have incoming regulation laws around disclosure. So we have the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, the CSRD, which is incoming, which requires larger corporations to disclose specific, both environmental but also social information around sustainability, which will be immensely helpful, not only for having valid information, but then also for enforcing these kind of things. So the market authority in future has a legal ground to actually regulate these kind of data points as well.
Now, a lot of our listeners, some of them are involved in smaller companies, some in medium-sized, and obviously we have people listening who are in large PLCs as well. Just to kind of walk us through this new CSRD regime, who it applies to and what kind of things must be disclosed under that regime.
So really, to begin with, it applies to large corporations, and the thresholds recently have been updated. So the original scope was a little bit larger than the ultimate one will be. It is a European regulation, so it will apply to European corporations. Yet at the same time, the value chain of a corporation is also covered. So there will be a larger scope outside of the EU. There's great numbers of how many companies outside of the EU will also be covered. You can also see this in terms of lobbying. So if you're looking at who had an interest in this regulation, you will see that a lot of US firms were also quite heavily involved, which tells you that, well, the scope, even though officially is Europe, it will probably have ramifications all around the globe. The CSRD, however, is not the only regulation out there. So the CSRD applies at entity level. So it's at corporation level. A company will have to disclose certain indicators at entity level. Yet we also have the taxonomy regulation, taxonomy for sustainable activities, it's called. And that applies at activity level, which is a very different angle to take. The CSRD is implemented using the European Sustainability Reporting Standards, which is a large list of indicators. So it is quite specific on what indicators need to be disclosed. They go around the three big topics that are the big buzzword in sustainability, ESG, so environmental, social, and governance. So the CSRD is really quite comprehensive because it goes beyond just environmental or just climate. The taxonomy, on the other hand, which applies at activity level, isn't it? Green taxonomy, so it's for environmental activities. Yet, I would like to remark that the taxonomy is quite ambitious because it covers six environmental objectives. Usually when people hear green or environment, the first thing that springs to mind is climate. Climate is not the only thing in the taxonomy. And even in climate, we both have mitigation as well as adaptation. So on the one hand, stopping climate change, stopping it getting worse, but on the other hand, also adapting to the new reality and preparing for what's to come. Besides the two climate objectives, the taxonomy then also covers water and marine resources, circular economy, pollution prevention, and biodiversity and ecosystems.
It sounds like, just listening to you, it sounds like a lot of extra disclosures, right? So I suppose the question obvious is how much of this is already being disclosed by large companies or how much is going to be new information? So if you're in the compliance department of a large company, is there a huge amount of increase in what you'll be disclosing, or would a lot of companies already be doing something like this or something approximating to it?
So a lot of companies did quite comprehensive disclosures, but the problem was that it's not standardized. So companies disclose the same topic, but in different numbers, which makes it impossible to compare across different companies because you're not really comparing apples to apples, but you're comparing an apple to a pear, which is both true. They fall under the same category, but you can't really make the perfect comparison. So that's what the CSRD and the taxonomy are really going to be very helpful with, because you get comparable information across different companies.
Now, in terms of making sure that the disclosures are accurate, are timely, and give the full picture or the true picture, that's going to presumably pose a huge challenge. I mean, if a company says this is what our supply chain looks like, this is how it operates, and these are the inputs into it, etc. I mean, yes, it can be there on paper and you can see the pictures and the graphs and the tables and all the rest, but who's actually going to go out and, dare I use this word, but audit what's disclosed? Is there any sort of, I suppose, either enforcement or something where the reliability of this can be tested in some way, all these CSRD disclosures? Is there any kind of body that will actually go ahead and say, is this actually the true picture of what we're seeing?
So the CSRD indeed is subject to assurance, which means an audit will take place, third party verification of this data. At the beginning, given that this is very, very new information that now needs to be disclosed, it will be limited assurance, but the idea is that that is subject to review and might increase in scope in the future as well.
So do you think it's a little bit of a bounty for audit firms who might be currently auditing the accounts of the companies, and now this is a second revenue stream they'll get?
Yeah, so you're posing a very interesting question here, because one thing that I haven't mentioned so far is it is quite comprehensive. ESG, so many topics to disclose, but everything is subject to materiality testing. Materiality means, is this relevant? Because you might be a company that's active in a certain area that doesn't at all touch on marine resources. So of course, then you wouldn't need to disclose on marine resources because it's not relevant to your business. It's not a material subject. Yet this materiality testing most likely will be outsourced as well. So this is a big chance for anyone working in this area and a huge new revenue stream coming up. Also, talking revenues, why am I in this field? It's also a big responsibility. And I'm teaching actually a subject in UCD that's called Sustainability Reporting and Analysis, which is very popular with students wanting to become an auditor, because this will be a huge job to actually check, did they define materiality correctly? Is this company reporting on all things that are material to the company? Are they green hushing and not mentioning certain topics, even though they are relevant indeed?
And Fabiola, do you have any idea what this auditing job might look like, just like in terms of sort of, you know, a day in the average life of an environmental disclosure auditor? Like what will they be doing? Is it very much sort of desktop auditing? Are they heading out and poking around supply chains and warehouses and all this sort of stuff? Like what will these people do in real life, so to speak?
Yeah, so it might be a little bit different to the usual audit work that is being carried out by the audits of financial reports. There actually is a big divide in how this area is evolving, because the skill set, as it might be different to what is required previously, the question is, are the auditors that are currently active in the space really the right people to carry out these audits? Or should we bring in people that have historically a lot of experience in environmental and sustainability fields? The counter argument then goes, well, but if you are usually an environmental consultant, you're not familiar with how a solid audit works, the processes, the governance, and all these things. So what I think is important is to have this interdisciplinary approach where we bring in the experience and the benefits that we acquired over the last years in both fields, from the environmental experts, but also the audit experts.
Because what really frustrates me, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but you see a lot of companies, and a lot of them would be in fossil fuels, and you know, they're big global companies with a huge amount of assets. And they say things like, you know, our operations are carbon neutral, or we're moving towards net zero in the next 4 to 5 years. But obviously, it's not so much that we're concerned with their internal company operations. What we're more concerned about is the product that they're retailing into the market. So is there companies who can sort of say and get a clean bill of health, a very positive disclosures about the company in question, but it's actually the more obvious and under their noses, the actual product they're turning out, that is the unsustainable piece? Is that something that the regulations here can deal with?
Oh, you're raising a very interesting point, and I hope I don't get too technical. I want to start by saying the Greenhouse Gas Protocol defines three scopes of emissions. So scope one is the direct emissions of a company. That's the nasty emissions you see coming from an exhaust pipe or a chimney, for example. But then that's not enough. You also need to report on scope two emissions. That's when you purchase energy. So say you run a business that's very high in electricity. Even though you don't see the emissions coming from your electricity socket, of course, that electricity comes from somewhere. So it means that probably if that electricity comes from a coal-fired facility, that there is emissions related to it, and you need to report on those, because ultimately to cause these emissions, right? Now, going a little bit more abstract, we're coming to scope three emissions. And scope three emissions cover the entire value chain. Value chain means it's both your supply chain, so everything that you purchase, all the goods, all the services. But on the other end of the value chain, it means it also covers your products. And that's exactly the point you just raised. Category, 11 of Scope 3 is use of products. And that is the most relevant company, especially for energy companies, because it is a bit short-sighted as an oil producer to say, well, yes, we're an oil company. Our product is fuels, fossil fuels, but we are not the ones burning it. We're just selling it, right? Fossil fuels, they go into cars, they go into airplanes, but ultimately it's not the energy company flying that airplane. It's not the car that they're driving. That's us. Now, this form of greenwashing has been called green shifting, because you're shifting on responsibility from who as the fossil fuel producer onto the consumer. But of course, just like a drug dealer claiming, well, I'm not the one using the drugs, I'm just the one selling it. That's shifting of responsibility, and you should take responsibility and accountability for your actions as a producer and seller of these goods.
So the ultimate purpose of all these, and I'm thinking back about corporate governance, which obviously is a lot older, many decades older. And it, you know, when those disclosures first came in, there was some very lofty ambitions for how they might change corporate behavior and corporate ethics and so on. In some ways they did, in other ways they didn't. That's a bigger debate. But what is the purpose of these, all this regulation? Do you see a changing behavior in the sense that companies will want to be better than their competitors? So there's a kind of a raising of standards. Do you think it's just better, as at least it allows investors to react? So if they can get all the information, they might have a different way of behaving and operating after seeing all the disclosures. Or is there just sort of a slight, you know, climate shaming thing going on here, where, you know, the public disclosure and the media, no doubt, will get a hold of some of these disclosures and go through them? So what do you see as the ultimate, I suppose, effect of all of this regime? Like, if I was to do a podcast with you 5 years from now, what do you think the world might look like after these disclosures sort of enter the public domain?
Oh, you don't need to wait 5 years. We already see the effects in the market, and that's really nice to see. I think it's a combination of all the things that you just mentioned. So yes, of course, transparency is the foundation for accountability. If we have all this information out there, on the one hand, NGOs and civil society can actually hold companies accountable for past claims and then for current performance. Without transparency, that's really hard to do. On the other hand, of course, it's supposed to be an incentive scheme. If we have all this information out there, financial market participants, such as investors, can actually make decisions based on these kind of data points. If you only have financial information, you can only make decisions based on financial information. Now, with all this new data and credible data hopefully coming in, that's opening up a lot of opportunities. And that's what we're seeing already. The European Commission published a report on the taxonomy, for example, recently, the sustainable activity regulation that I mentioned, where we see that the uptake is really huge. Companies are reporting these figures, and then other market participants, such as banks, can make decisions based on it. Green bonds, for example, now use taxonomy alignment. So does the taxonomy declare something green or not in their reporting? There's also passive investment benchmarks, the climate transition benchmark or Paris aligned benchmark, PABs and CTBs, which track carbon performance. So in this portfolio, if you have a Paris aligned benchmark, you then have 7% year-on-year emission reduction across all three scopes. So including, for example, that scope 3 use of product data point that I just mentioned. And that's a great way to see how this data can actually be applied in the real world to make a profit at the same time as having an impact in terms of sustainability. And these last benchmarks that I mentioned have seen huge popularity in the market. We know it's close to 200 billion at the moment, the market. So that's really promising to see that this information is useful and is being used.
So what you're saying is that there's real life concrete emission reductions at the end of all of this reporting and maintenance of annual reports. So that's good to hear.
That's sure what this is supposed to drive, yes.
Obviously, global emissions are continuing to struggle here in Ireland. We are struggling to reach our targets. So do you see the problems being in other areas, but at least the corporate sector is going to get its own house a bit more in order on the back of this disclosure regime?
If you're asking me if I'm an optimist, I'm not too sure about that. I would say I'm pragmatic. We can only track progress if we have reliable data, and we're getting more and more reliable data by the day, which is really good to see. For anyone making these kind of estimations and these kind of projections, I would always say on the side of the planet, apply the precautionary principle. So when you estimate estimations, just take the highest number that you can, because thereby you incentivize disclosure. If I have an estimate of a number and then the real number is actually lower, a company has the incentive to disclose the real number. Whereas if I make estimations and the real number is higher, how likely is the company to disclose?
And one of the really innovative parts is how the information and data is gathered. I see that you're looking at some of the ideas of using artificial intelligence platforms to detect greenwashing in the market more generally. Can you tell us a little bit about that sort of emerging area and how much of an impact? I know it's early days in the evolution of AI, but how much impact that could have, or much impact it could bring to the structure of this data regime?
So I'm actually co-leading something called Greenwatch. It's a research initiative at UCD. We used to be funded by Science Foundation Ireland because we participated in a competition called AI for Good. So that's the mission that got us started. We wanted to see if we can leverage AI to do some good in financial markets. We're now funded by Enterprise Ireland because there's actually quite a lot of commercial interest in this project. And what we do is the problem with all these reports and all these data figures and so on is the scalability. So while, yes, I could go in a report and read 30 pages, that's going to take me a lot of time. Given that we see this huge shift towards passive investment and large portfolios, it's very difficult to do this at scale in the right time. So what AI can help us to do is scale our efforts, which means it's very fast. You can track data in time and hold companies accountable much more quickly and at a larger scale rather than having to do it one by one.
So in other words, it's just less labor intensive, which means that the whole thing is less costly, which means companies are likely to be more, enthusiastic about doing it if it costs them less. Is that the idea of it?
Yes. So you can see, you can look at it as a way of greenwashing protection. So if you have a large portfolio and you don't have the time to go through every company and you just take the big headline figures or the big headline claims that they make, you run risk of being greenwashed because you don't have the time to actually scrutinize each and one of them, which means overall there's a high greenwashing risk. If we now have the tools to actually in time, so not just 5 years later, but really at the point of decision, we can assess the risk of greenwashing for a larger amount of companies at portfolio level. We then reduce the risk of being greenwashed, which means that companies know that they can't greenwash as much anymore, which should incentivize, again, accountability and therefore better performance.
Obviously, Ireland and the UK as well, they're primarily services-based economies. They don't have, certainly Ireland doesn't have a lot of heavy manufacturing. So are the disclosures you're most looking forward to seeing, presumably, are in the manufacturing sector where carbon emissions traditionally have tended to be higher? So we're looking to see what happens there. It's a bit easier in a service company where you're asset light and you know your product is a service, obviously. So will there be a big difference, you think, between the disclosures that the kind of brown industries have and those other ones? Are you expecting to see quite a big disparity there?
Not at all. So historically, the fossil fuel sectors, the heavy sectors are regulated much more heavily. What we see, and RepRisk has great data on that, is that the most greenwashing incidents in the last year actually occurred in financial services and the financial sector. That's because a lot of banks will make big sustainability claims, yet they're not really great on their disclosures because, again, for banks, the most important disclosure would be scope 3, category 15, that's investments. So it's not about how green are your light bulbs, do you actually source green electricity for your offices, because the biggest impact you have on climate is your investments, where you spend your money, who do you give loans to, and so on. So reporting on the green asset ratio, how many green assets do you have versus how much fossil fuel financing do you do, that's the really important bit. And there's still a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah, we see a lot of, obviously, in the consumer space, a lot of green mortgages. I don't know, you might know, but I presume there's green corporate loans also being issued by a lot of companies. Is that something you'd like to see? Because it's highlighting, you know, the green issue, but the underlying elements of the product I don't know as much about. So is that something that you take optimism from, those kind of lending products, or are you a little bit more suspicious of them?
Lending, the issue of transparency persists because lending usually happens bilaterally or between a few banks and a larger corporation. So as a researcher, it's very hard to scrutinize them. And green bonds have come under fire because the promises on additionality and the promises on ring fencing might not always have been met. What I'm a big fan of is sustainability-linked bonds. The bond market in general is a great way for researchers to assess credibility because bonds are publicly traded, so it's much easier to get information on them. There's a lot of more disclosures and they're much more standardized than, say, a loan, which happens between a bank and their customer. So it's hard to find scrutiny. The beauty of sustainability-linked bonds is that they're forward-looking, because in this sustainability-linked bond, you actually commit to a sustainability performance target. In 5 years' time, I will have reduced my emissions 7% year on year. And if you do, you get a reward because your coupon payment goes down. Which is a great incentive both for the company to actually follow through with their targets, but also for the provider of capital, because they can either claim impact, and if not, they at least get compensated for missing out on this promise.
And these sustainable linked bonds, these SLBs, are they quite prevalent in Europe yet, or are we at an early stage? Just how much issuance of them is there out there?
So it is quite a new market. Green bonds have been around for much, much more, many more years than sustainability-linked bonds, which are only coming into full-fledged now. 2019 was the first time one was issued by an Italian utility company. They have been, though, the fastest growing instrument. Now, it is a new market. There's still room for improvement in terms of standardization and uptake, but it's really promising in terms of uptake and growth of the market. So they're taking on a lot of share in the sustainability or in the sustainable finance space.
Okay, well, that's great. It's great to see, because obviously you need two to play there. Obviously, the company to issue them and then the investors to absorb them. So it sounds like both sides are playing their part at this early stage.
Yeah, certainly in terms of demand. So both green bonds and sustainability-linked bonds are hugely oversubscribed, which means there's much more investors, people wanting to buy them than there is on offer, which really shows you that the financial sector is also keen on doing their part and being the lever for sustainability that they can be.
That's great to hear. I mean, I certainly get a sense we're at an early stage. So if you've already got oversubscription, we're coming off a good base, which is good to see over the next few years as they roll out. Listen, thank you very much for the conversation. It's been great. You've got green shifting, green labeling. what were the other two or three you had there? I've got two down already. You had a few others, though.
We talked about green labeling, green lighting, green shifting, green hushing. We mentioned also when companies just don't disclose. Two more if you want. Green rinsing is when a company waters down their ESG targets before they are achieved. So today I make a big claim, I make a big marketing campaign on my target. 5 years down the line, I quietly forget that I ever said that. I make a new target, which sounds kind of similar, but it's a few years later and slightly different. So again, I can make a big announcement and no one realizes that the past target I kind of just forgot about. Green crowding is when you hide in a crowd so you can rely on the safety
bad,
in numbers.
We're the best of the bad lot sort of thing. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and no one has a feeling for those kind of big numbers, especially in the sustainability space when it's beyond currencies and euros and US dollars and so on.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few airlines that do like to say kind of fall into that green crowd issue as well, you know. Listen, Fabiola, we could talk a lot about this. We could probably do 3, 4, 5 podcasts, but unfortunately we're not paid or have the time to do any of that to that extent, but it's been certainly a good first taster of what's out there for people who are interested in sustainable finance. You've given them a good flavour of what's going on, the different initiatives at European level and those new bond products that are quite innovative and helping companies to make a wider social contribution and investors likewise. But for the moment, thank you for joining us on Business Impact. That is Dr. Fabiola Schneider, who is an assistant professor here at UCD Business School. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Now, if you enjoyed this week's episode of the UCD Business Impact Podcast, please subscribe to episodes on Apple Podcast or Spotify. We cover a broad range of topics with insights from business leaders around the world, so there is sure to be something there for everyone. I'd like to thank our production team of Beth Gormley and Mike Liffey. They work tirelessly in the background, sourcing interviewees, editing, promoting episodes, and everything in between. I've been your host, Emmett Oliver, and we hope you can join us next time on UCD Business Impact.